You're listening to Igniting Imagination, a podcast to spark the spirit within you from Wesleyan Impact Partners. Discover how you can join us in a spirit-led movement to bring about human flourishing grounded in love, generosity, and belonging by visiting ignitingimagination.org.
Hello, and welcome back to Igniting Imagination. I'm your host, Lisa Greenwood, and joining me is my dear friend and co-host for this season, Shannon Hopkins. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Lisa. It's so good to be with you.
So our theme this season is Facing Reality, Claiming Leadership. And if you followed this podcast and our work, we've talked a lot about grief and what it means to grieve well as congregations, as communities. We know we cannot face reality and claim leadership without facing grief. Our guest today, Dr. Pauline Boss, helps us face grief through facing what she calls ambiguous loss. And friends, this loss is truly all around us. We have all experienced ambiguous loss through the pandemic. We will all experience ambiguous loss over the course of our lives. If you're wondering what ambiguous loss means, Dr. Boss shares about it throughout our episode. So stay tuned for her full insights. But Shannon, will you share a bit from Dr. Boss's writing?
Yeah, listen to these words from Dr. Boss. Ambiguous loss is a loss that remains unclear without official verification or immediate resolution, which may never be achieved. The people we love can be physically gone, but kept psychologically present, or the opposite, physically present, but psychologically gone. It is often a disenfranchised grief because others do not see the loss as credible and worthy of grief.
Yeah.
So you can think about this. Think about everything from infertility to the disappearance of a family member, prisoners of wars, divorce, Alzheimer's disease. In the last few years related to the pandemic and the changes in our world, loss of hopes, dreams, plans for the future, loss of certainty about safety, loss of trust in institutions, in leaders, the world being fair and just. The list could go on and on and on.
Yes, yes. This is what I mean. It is everywhere. It is all around us. All of us experience ambiguous loss. So this conversation is powerful and poignant and really on point, I think, for all of us. So listeners and those viewing on our YouTube channel, I am so grateful you're tuning in. And as always, we love hearing from you. So please reach out and email us with your responses and reactions to this episode and how it is resonating with you and what questions it is illuminating for you. We've put Dr. Boss's bio in our show notes and on our website. And we do recommend that you visit Dr. Boss's website at ambiguousloss.com for her writings and the Ambiguous Loss online training program and so much more. So Shannon, what stood out to you about our conversation with Pauline?
Oh my gosh. Lisa, I think one of the things that really struck me is how timely this work is, that she's been at this work for over 50 years, but this mm-hmm. is the work for now. And I think one right. of the things that stood out is just, this is a gift to us in ministry yeah. today.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, also just the distinction between loss and grief, I think I'm going to be sitting with and wrestling with for months to come.
Right. Yeah. So certainly as we think about facing reality and naming reality, the importance of naming our loss, recognizing it and naming it as a really important part of the grieving process, but also the healing, not closure. She's real clear about that, but the healing process. Yeah.
I think the other thing that's, you know, she really talks about how we live when we're swimming in the waters of ambiguous loss, like how important both and thinking is, how important yes. it is to have relationships that are good enough that, you know,
just, oh yeah. Yeah. That's really,
yeah. There's just, this is rich. This is a really rich conversation. So,
yeah. So let's listen to our conversation with Dr. Pauline Boss.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Boss, thank you for being with us today. We have so been looking forward to this conversation.
It's my pleasure, Lisa. It's my pleasure. I should say Reverend Lisa.
Lisa is just fine and so delightful to be with you. So you coined this term ambiguous loss quite a while ago in the 1970s, actually, and then wrote the book Ambiguous Loss in 2000. And that term has certainly seemed to be more widely used since the pandemic, which is actually when I became acquainted with your work as well. Mm-hmm. And people have started using this term ambiguous loss to describe what we're regularly experience. So I want to start there and hear from you how you came to this concept of ambiguous loss, what it is, and then what about our current reality, if you will, makes this idea of ambiguous loss so important today?
Well, there are two answers to that question. The first one was I was a doctoral student at the University of Wisconsin, sitting in with psychiatrist Carl Whitaker, learning how to do family therapy. And the families who came, the identified patient was the child in all the families. And the fathers were angry about being there, and said, don't you know that the children are mother's business and I should be at work? And so after seeing that over and over again, I wrote my first academic paper, which was Psychological Father Absence in Intact Families, meaning he was there but not there. Yeah. And my professor of theory construction said to me, Pauline, it's about more than fathers. Raise it to a higher level. And it took me a while. I was still, but by the time I wrote my doctoral dissertation, I came up with the term ambiguous loss. The second part of that answer, though, is that I grew up in an immigrant family. And my father had immigrated from Switzerland. He intended to go back, but couldn't go back because it was a depression and he didn't have enough money. And then it was World War II and he couldn't go back. So he would get letters from his mother and his brothers and sisters. And I could see that he was very sad. And then when letters came with a black border, meaning someone died, then he would be grieving. And I didn't know that family he was grieving for. So I always knew he had another family, but it was somewhere across the ocean. So then I lived in a village where everybody was an immigrant. It was New Glarus, Wisconsin, all Swiss people who had immigrated or their parents had immigrated. So that homesickness was a general condition. And I grew up around that. And I think that's where the term ambiguous loss really came from.
Well, it's interesting because I was pausing because I'm really struck by that sense of homesickness being a part of loss. And, you know, so many people, you know, live in different communities than where they're from. And I just, I don't know, that wasn't where we were going to go with this, but I was just struck in listening to your story, Dr. Boss, about, I wonder, you know, if part of what people are losing in this moment is this sense of just having a simplicity of connection.
Well, we're a nation of immigrants. We've forgotten that. That our legacy is, in fact, ambiguous loss, that is, leaving family behind across the ocean or across the country or even in another state. There's a great deal of movement in what we do, and migration and immigration are the basis of this country. Yet we hate the term loss. If you go to a conference, there are very few seminars on loss, and if so, only a few people attend. If you look at indexes in books, the term loss is rarely there. Grief is more common, but I think we should talk about loss as being the forerunner of grief or unresolved grief. And we are a culture that likes winning. We don't like losing. And so we need to face the fact that we have many, many kinds of things we cannot control, many kinds of things that we lose during the pandemic. We were not in control of our own lives or our own routines. That's why we bake bread. Yeah. Do you remember how many people bake bread during the pandemic?
Yeah.
It was a couple hours of control and certainty. You knew how it would turn out, and in fact, it would be a wonderful outcome. I thought that was an extraordinarily good coping mechanism for when you're out of control, to find something small you can control. It could be exercising. It could be music. It could be anything where you feel in control, cleaning a closet or baking bread. So other cultures, for example, Eastern cultures, have less trouble dealing with being out of control, with tolerating ambiguity. We're a mastery-oriented culture, which, of course, is a good thing because, you know, we have been very successful with that, found a vaccine for most things. Put a camera in far outer space now. It's just amazing what our mastery orientation can do. But there are things in life we can't control. And then we have trouble. We have great trouble. We want certainty, and there is not certainty all the time.
I think that's such an interesting thread, that our legacy is one of ambiguous loss. Like, that's in the DNA of our culture. And yet we're a culture that likes winning. You've referred in your work often to, we're a problem-solving culture, or even that sense of being mastery-oriented. But how, when that's the case, when that's where we're at, how do we really learn? I mean, are there other ways other than baking bread that we can learn to sit with our unanswered questions?
Yes, there are. The one I write about in The Myth of Closure, and probably before too, but I've forgotten where I write things. Both and thinking is something we need to learn to do. And we tend, when something is ambiguous, for example, the pandemic virus, or for example, a problem in your church, when there's not a clear answer, we tend to shut it down and try to forget about it, or we tend to go to an absolute answer. You're wrong, I'm right. And you see it, by the way, globally and nationally now too. And that kind of absolute thinking will get us nowhere but deadlock. And we have to move toward the center, toward both and thinking. I disagree with you, but I also want to be your neighbor. I disagree with you, but I also love you. I happen to have that in my family. I disagree with a family member, and I also love them. So we have what's called a good enough relationship where we can talk about food, we can talk about grandchildren, but we can't talk about politics and religion. So should I cut this person off? No, I think that's the easy way. What do the young people call that now? What is it?
Cancel culture.
Cancel culture. Yes. And they just shut them off and never talk to them again. A ghosting, it's also called.
Right.
I think that's the easy way out. And I also think it's cruel. It seems to me, and this is more your department than mine, morality, but it seems to me we need to practice the golden rule more than we are. And this is the one rule set in different ways that precedes Christianity, and it's in every religion that is on this earth, and in philosophy, Socrates even talked about it. And sometimes it's reversed. Do not do to others that you do not want done to you. I believe in the Jewish religion, it's reversed, but it's the same idea. And we are not practicing it today. We are cutting people off if we disagree with them. We cannot tolerate ambiguity, and we have to increase our ability to do that, just as Eastern cultures have.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this this yes and, acknowledging where the other person is, naming it, and then saying, and I can sit with you in this. I don't have to agree with you, but I can still be in relationship with you. And I'm thinking about this whole season, it for us is about facing reality. So this naming piece feels really important. Naming where the other person is, naming the unanswered question, naming the ambiguous loss, if you will. Can you talk a little bit about why that's so important?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. It comes right out of stress theory. It's not a medical psychological model. It's a stress model because Lazarus, back another generation, said, you can't cope with something unless you know what the problem is. So the problem has to have a name. You know how it is if you go to the doctor and they'll say, something is wrong with you, but I don't know what it is. That's very stressful.
Yes.
So we need to give it a name when we have people we disagree with, when we have things we have lost, not a clear-cut death. I'm not talking about a clear-cut death, but give it a name, an ambiguous loss. In a congregation, if there is division, that's an ambiguous loss for both sides. And what you would want to happen is for people to understand that both and thinking, and you gave it the improvisational name, yes and, yes. Which is from improvisational theater, which is correct, absolutely correct, yes and.
The only way forward, right?
It's the only way forward. Otherwise, you're stuck. And your grief is also unresolvable. You're stuck. And it's a very bad place to be. And the worst thing that could happen if it becomes permanent, which is like ghosting, and you don't talk to the other people, you literally split into two separate congregations. That's a tragedy because some of these people, I would guess, have known each other for decades, perhaps. So what you do is you start thinking in a new way. In other words, your perception has to change, because the disagreement won't change. So we're not saying you have to change your way of thinking, but we're saying you have to be civil to each other nevertheless and say to yourself, I disagree with the way you're thinking, but I'm willing to sit with you. And I said, but that's wrong. I both disagree with you and am willing to sit with you in a congregation. You see, I have a Swiss background, so I'm very mastery oriented, and this is difficult for me too. But I have made major progress personally in being able to do this, and I have to tell you, it has a depth in it that is very rewarding, and I think I will continue to do it with some other people I disagree with. I don't have heavy disagreements except this one in the family. So that's where I think I've done the most work, and I feel like there's been progress.
It's notable that this happens at an individual level, as you've spoken, you know, you and a family member, and I think all of us have situations where we disagree, but we stay in relationship, or I hope we do. But also this happens at the corporate level, and you've referred to that too. And that feels notable. This can happen individually, but it also happens in groups of people, has impact on our congregations and how we show up in the world.
I would add that it happens with nation states as well. You're seeing it now on TV. And in fact, there have been a couple articles written about using the both and method, because if you want one absolute outcome, frequently it is less possible than negotiation. And sometimes negotiation isn't possible. I understand that. But wouldn't we try more often? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't we try to get along with our neighbor, even though we don't think the way they do? Everybody has children we care about. We care about the next generation. Wouldn't that be a guiding principle, is how can we live together and protect each other's children?
I'm just struck, though, that you mentioned, Dr. Boss, that this has a depth to it. Like, it requires us to go deep. But this is at a time in culture where everything's causing us to speed up, and like consumerism and individualism and social media keep us living in a more shallow, quick way. And this requires us to sit with one another, to actually have deep and real conversations.
Well, technology is binary, and it creates binary thinking. You're either right or you're wrong. I either like you or I ghost you. I hate you. Don't want anything to do with you anymore. And you either win or you lose. Well, sometimes you kind of win and kind of lose. It isn't like the sports games where there's an absolute answer. In human relationships, it is frequently ambiguous, more ambiguous than, let's say, in accounting or in a trial where somebody wins or loses, and in sports where someone wins or loses. Those are absolutes. And we like that there. Mm-hmm. But in human relationships, as I like your phrase, igniting imagination, we have to imagine a better way to be with each other, a kinder way. And we cannot deny, for example, that somebody is gone if they are still alive. Yes, people die, and we have death certificates, and we have certainty. We have funerals. So we have rituals that help us make that real. But with ambiguous loss, we have none of those. No rituals, no acknowledgement. And yet we feel anger and sadness and sorrow, and we may not know why, because something was taken from us that isn't so visible. Or something is harming us that isn't visible. The world is in a bad place right now, if I may say so. And we have to change our ways or we'll destroy each other. Mm. And that means we have to get along with people we disagree with. Hopefully the disagreements aren't 100%, that there's some room in there for common ground, even if it's tiny. And that we have to increase our tolerance for ambiguity and not always insist on certainty and absolutes. How do we do that?
Well, that was going to be my question. Yes.
Oh, was that?
I was going to say, how do we do this? How do we increase our tolerance for ambiguity, please?
Well, you have to embrace change. And of course, change is stressful. None of us really likes change. But you have to embrace change, and certainly if you have children, you know that the next generation always wants change, so we learn. They're good teachers for us about this. You have to be with people unlike yourself, and that means, at a party or in your neighborhood or at your school or your workplace, get to know somebody who's unlike yourself and find out your common ground. And in fact, that's very exciting to do that. Travel alone to a foreign country, learn a new language, do something different. What it means is do something different that you haven't done before. And exercise yourself. The psychiatrist I studied with, Carl Whitaker, after he died, I went to the funeral. And his grandchildren spoke, and they were telling us their favorite thing to do with their grandfather, my teacher, my psychiatry teacher. And they all said he would invite them one by one into the car and say, let's go get lost. And they loved it. Wow. And they'd have no agenda, no destination in mind, but they would just meander in the car. So I tried it with my grandchildren, and they loved it and still remember it to this day. And when my husband was in his last year and couldn't walk and was quite ill, on a Sunday, I would take him in the car and I'd say, north, south, east, or west. And he would say, and we would just take off with no plans. Mm-hmm. We would get lost. And it was just such fun. Try that sometime. And if you're in a city and you don't drive, try it with walking. Take a new route. Take a new path. Do something different to stretch your ability to tolerate ambiguity and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. We hang on to this mastery orientation of wanting to be in control. So we do the same thing every day, which is comforting. And I'm not saying give that up, but sprinkle in some ambiguity and test yourself. Of course, there are other things to do. As you mentioned, improvisation theater is totally performance on the basis of ambiguity. Also, jazz music is totally improvised. And you can improvise something. You know, have a meeting without an agenda. Try something different. So increase your own tolerance. Right now, for me, that means talking to somebody that I know I will disagree with.
It's making me think of a couple of things. Barbara Brown Taylor talks about wandering in the dark and the gift of that wandering.
That's lovely.
And I'm also thinking that, you know, the neuroscience about neuroplasticity is right in line with this thinking, right? And I didn't connect this when you first started talking, but as you talked, I thought, I remember in our own family therapy as we were trying to increase our tolerance for change and things, our therapist said, simple things, move your toothbrush to the other side of the sink. I mean, do things that's just stretch your brain, and even that will help us show up, you know, with more tolerance for ambiguity and change and for differences in each other. And
I agree. Do something different.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to take this then to this conversation in congregations who I think are facing so much ambiguous loss right now. And I say that because of how the culture has changed and how, you know, all the statistics about how fewer and fewer people are affiliating with membership-based organizations, from churches to Rotary clubs, building. You know, we know this data out there. And so what's happening in congregations is this kind of ambiguous loss. And then, of course, the pandemic, and we could go on and on about this. But I've heard you talk about the difference between and write about the difference between grieving loss that is more tangible, if you will, that you can name and see, and, you know, and the clearest example is someone dies and we have rituals around that, and they're beautiful and they're important, but we don't have rituals around ambiguous loss. And so the grieving process is different. Can you talk a bit about the differences and then any thoughts you have to help congregations grieve ambiguous loss that is so prevalent in this season?
Let me give a brief definition first, and then I'll go into the grieving part. So there are two kinds of ambiguous loss. One is physical and one is psychological. Mm-hmm. The physical ambiguous loss would be when you describe the membership in churches going down, where the physical bodies are just not there anymore. No one has died, so we're not talking about death, but they just have disappeared. Psychological ambiguous loss would be when the person is there, but the mind is gone. For example, dementia or addiction or serious mental illnesses where the person is no longer the way you can communicate with them. They're psychologically absent. And certainly what I talked about ghosting would be that kind of example where I'm not going to talk to you anymore, even though you're still living, but you're cut off. So what happens to the people left behind is they feel a sorrow and a grief, but it's not, they're stuck. It's not like grieving for someone who has died. You have a body to bury, you have a death certificate. It's a very ambiguous loss. Therefore, the grief is frozen. And in the Harvard book, the 2000 book, I wrote about frozen grief. Mm-hmm. So the grief process cannot move forward. It is stuck because nobody died. And if you grieve, then you're wishing somebody dead who's not dead. Then you feel guilty about that. And so it's fraught with problems. And if you talk to people with either physically missing or psychologically missing, they will describe this for you. They feel sad. They want to grieve. But then they feel guilty if they grieve too soon. Nobody died yet.
Right.
And so we have to focus on the type of loss, the nuance of loss that causes this stress, that causes this frozen grief. And what can you do with it? I think, again, both and thinking helps you. I need to move forward with my life, and I also need to feel this sadness. Think about how it would be if you had a child who was kidnapped. And I have had examples of people who find hope in the middle of such tragedy. They are our teachers. And many of us have much more minor ambiguous losses, like we just disagree with our neighbor. I'm not going to talk to him anymore. That is something we should get over and find some basic common ground. Maybe it would be real minor, how we mow our lawn. We both like how we mow our lawn. and you could talk about that. Again, it's a good enough relationship. It's not 100%. But let's settle for good enough instead of cutting off into saying, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. And by the way, if you continue to move to this middle ground, your sorrow, I think, is less with an ambiguous loss. Because if you take a very firm stance, then you too are isolated. And isolation, as we know, never helps with sadness and sorrow. I tend to use the term sadness and sorrow as opposed to grief, because the grief is really frozen. It's not real grief. It's sadness. And real grief can come after a clear-cut loss, like a death. But with ambiguous losses, you're stuck. You're stuck in a limbo of not knowing whether to move backwards or forwards or stay where you are. And it's a very uncomfortable and stressful place to be.
Gosh, I have so much in following up to that. But one thing that I'm wondering about, and again, in relationship to congregations, is there's a group that I know here in the UK called Stewarding Loss. That's the name of their organization, is Stewarding Loss. And it's about recognizing that as institutions change and culture changes, some organizations aren't going to survive. But we need to actually steward what's being lost. And I wonder how that phrase or that term strikes you, stewarding loss. And do you think there's something that leaders of congregations, do they need new, is this part of their role? And do they need new skills or new training to be able to help steward loss in this time?
I like the term stewarding loss, because they're using the term loss, and all too often people prefer the term grief. And in this case, as I just said, the grief is stuck. So we need to focus on the word loss. So I like that term. And yes, you don't need to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist to teach people about ambiguous loss and this way of thinking. Psychoeducation can be learned. Nurses use it. Teachers use it. Ordinary people use it in the field after disasters. While a professional may do the first training, you train local people to take over because the professional has to go home eventually. And so it's very possible to learn, read the books. There, you know, I've written 4 or 5 books on it. Lots of literature. The website is ambiguousloss.com. And there's an online course for learning to getting a certificate or CEUs in ambiguous loss through the University of Minnesota. It's also at that website. So I would say teach it, learn it yourself, and then teach it to others. Use the literature so that it's correct. There are certain things that I found that are wrong. Some people use the term ambiguous grief. That is a wrong term. Mm-hmm. If ambiguous loss leads to frozen grief, unresolved grief, disenfranchised grief, don't use that other term. So it's ambiguous loss leads to frozen, disenfranchised, unresolvable grief. And other than that, most people are teaching it correctly in schools, in disaster areas, and in churches, synagogues, and so on. So go for it. Go for it. You have my blessing.
That distinction between ambiguous loss that then leads to frozen grief, that distinction between ambiguous loss and this misuse of the term of ambiguous grief, that feels really helpful to me. And so I'm going to hold on to that notion of ambiguous loss. I want to switch to the book that you wrote in 2021, because it is so challenging to me. The title, The Myth of Closure. Oh, Pauline, why is closure a myth? Tell me it is not so. But I know this is the mastery culture at coming out in my body and my mind. I know that.
Me too.
Yeah.
No, it's not a myth in real estate deals and business deals when you sign a contract. It's not a myth in Minnesota when there's a snowstorm and they close a road. Closure is a perfectly good word, but it's not a good word in human relationships. Again, it implies absolute thinking, shutting somebody out just because you disagree with them. Or the myth that if someone you love dies, that you need to find closure and get over it. You know, you have a couple months at work, you might have 3-4 days to get back to work. Or even in our profession, you might have a year to stop grieving. That's all wrong. The research now shows that's wrong. There is no timeline for grief. It's more like oscillation, where it ebbs and flows over time. But 20 years after somebody you love dies, you may see something, hear something, some music, or be in a certain place, and you'll have a tear again. That is normal. Mm. You do not have to get over it. Of course, the oscillation goes farther and farther apart. The ebbs and flows go farther and farther apart as time goes on. But 3/4 of people grieve normally. About 1/4 need psychological or psychiatric help or counseling help. And yet we have made all grief seem abnormal. And we have pathologized grief. Mm. And we need to stop that. It's stressful. It's painful. But most of us can work through it if we have some social support, which was a little harder during the pandemic, but thank God for Zoom. And we need to not pathologize grief, because for most people, they grieve normally. And cultures, by the way, grieve in different ways. So we cannot Americanize the pathology of grief. And that is happening.
Yeah.
So we have to take a step back and say, what's normal here? So I spent a lot of time on that topic in the myth of closure as well. And know that we just need to be kind to each other. Again, human contact is helpful. Bring something to the door. Just sit with someone. Invite them to lunch. I mean, these are simple human things, mm-hmm. but they are very therapeutic for the normal pain of losing somebody you love.
So when I hear you describe that and speak about the myth of closure, I hear so much permission giving in that and so much grace. Like there is a generosity of spirit that says, let's normalize that grief, loss, sadness can continue and that's okay. Like grace is the word that comes to mind. There's a grace in that.
Yes,
there's,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have to witness it. And I think why our country is so reluctant to talk about grief, to witness it, is Andrew Gilpin Faust, who was president of Harvard, wrote a book about that our inability to handle grief and loss really came from the Civil War, and that our country was formed on the pain of loss. And the Civil War had many ambiguous losses because the soldiers were not named. They were just buried. So parents didn't know where their loved one was or if they were dead or alive. So our country, and by the way, that's not the only thing. There was the genocide of the Native Americans at the beginning. There was slavery when loved ones, when families were sold apart from each other, children were sold away from their parents, their mothers. We are a nation of unresolved grief. You are just seeing some of that happening right now, especially regarding Black Lives Matter, for example. Slavery was a horrendous time. But we have had, and we're a nation of immigrants, so that even if the immigration was wanted, was volitional, there was ambiguous loss there. So I think we're a nation that doesn't like to talk about loss. We like to talk about winning. But we have to get over that, because loss is a part of everyday life. It's part of our heritage. And we need to know how to deal with it in a kindly and graceful way, as you say. And we haven't done that yet. We don't like to witness other people suffering. We can learn from our Eastern brothers and sisters about tolerating suffering. I know that in my 2006 book, I have a quote, a Tibetan quote, that thinking you don't have to suffer is ego wanting its own way.
Mm. Wow.
Suffering is part of life. Uh-huh. And we don't like to hear that. Mm. We like to be in charge. It's ego wanting its own way. And suffering is part of life. And we hope, we don't hope for it, but it seems to find us eventually.
It's just so hard, though, in our culture when we do want to be a culture of winners, like when we like winning. But it seems to me that's a place the church and congregational leaders can really help us. They can help us witness and name loss. They can help name what's going on.
And normalize it.
And I do feel like, for me, it feels like this is a great opportunity for faith leaders in this moment. I mean, I don't know.
I agree.
You know, because I live in London and the Queen died last year, we saw the church really help the nation grieve. And honestly, it was really the first time I've seen that in such a powerful way. And really, the church gave us rituals. So I do feel like this is a moment that if what we need to do is witness and name the ambiguous loss all around us, then this right. is a moment faith leaders could really kind of bring their gift to the forefront. Anyway, that's what I'm hearing.
Witnessing of it. Yes, I agree with what you're saying. And somebody has to acknowledge the ambiguous loss, let's say, of a congregant whose loved one has dementia. We have to talk about it. We have to support that person. And we have to take care of each other if we have ambiguous losses. And sometimes it doesn't mean saying anything. It just means being there, sitting beside them. And if it's someone you disagree with, again, with those ambiguous losses, make a move forward. It can be tiny, just hand them something, or just sit beside them, or just say hello. It doesn't have to be a major coming together. It probably will never be a major coming together 100%. Doesn't need to be. Do it good enough. Mm-hmm. A good enough relationship happens a lot. And yeah. It's okay.
So I want to build on that a little bit because I think you're right. There's this role for leaders in this season to help bridge some of these moments or divides, to help individuals who are experiencing ambiguous loss to name it and face it. I'm also thinking about. And I'm not sure I'm going to get the wording exactly right on this, so forgive while I kind of weave my way through this. But I think part of the work of leaders is to create an environment where people can be formed in the faith and how they live in the world, right? And so, yes, there are moments and incidents where you help someone through an ambiguous loss or a division or things like that, but also how are people formed in congregations so that they live in a way that they can step into, hold space for ambiguity in their lives. And so I'm wondering, think aloud with us a moment, if you will, for what it means for a leader to help create that kind of space and help form people so that they are equipped, if you will, to name and face and sit with ambiguity and particularly ambiguous loss. Is that making sense?
Yes, it does. And this is a problem that has no solution. You know, people sure. will not, for example, agree 100%. The person with dementia probably won't get better. And worldwide now, the missing people, probably most of them will never be found in earthquakes and wars, in hostage taking. So we're talking about a problem that has no solution. In my 2006 book, I give 6 guidelines for living with ambiguous loss. In other words, it won't be solved. You may have to live with this missing person physically or psychologically for the rest of your life. How do you do that, coming from a mastery-oriented culture that wants to solve problems? And I don't believe in linear models. And Kubler-Ross, we need to say, retracted her linear model before she died too, but many people don't read her last books. And so it's messy, she said. And yeah. this is messy too. So while I give you the 6 guidelines, one after the other, know that they're in a circle and you can dive in wherever you want. The first one is finding meaning. And this takes sometimes a year or more. Finding meaning in a loss. Now, when an old grandfather dies, that's not so hard to find meaning because of age. But when a baby dies, or when a soldier is shot by friendly fire, or a suicide, those are very difficult. And sometimes they will rest on meaninglessness. The meaning of this loss is that it has no meaning. It'll never make sense. And that's okay. That's a good meaning for that kind of loss. Another one is reconstructing your identity. The minute there is ambiguous loss, even in a congregation, your identity shifts. And that's very, it's turning out to be one of the most important of the six guidelines. Ah. And if you have a missing person in your life, for example, you say, am I still married or not? Mm. He's been missing for 20 years. And I hear you saying that, are we still a congregation or are we not? That's a very good question to struggle with. And then another one is you normalize ambivalence, which we talked about before. The fact that you want to grieve, then you feel guilty for grieving because you're wishing the person dead. Normalize that guilt. Guilt just comes along with this. Mm-hmm. And so normalize it, unless it goes into self-harm or harm of someone else or retribution. I'm going to kill you because of what you did to me. I wouldn't normalize that. And then it's revising attachment. So your attachment is now different to the person who is ambiguously lost. You have to revise that. It's very tenuous. And so you hold on to the attachment to the person who's missing, but you must also at the same time attach to someone else who is physically present and psychologically present. We mentioned that with caregivers, for example. You can go visit your loved one who no longer knows who you are, but you really need to have lunch periodically with somebody who is fully present for you.
Yeah.
And then finally, you're discovering new hope. So you don't hope for what used to be. You hope for something new. Congregation may never be the way it used to be, but it could be something different. And that could morph into something even more exciting, more meaningful as time goes on. Mm-hmm. And as Viktor Frankl said, and I base a lot of my work on Viktor Frankl, said there is no meaning without hope and no hope without meaning, which means that circle just joined on meaning and hope.
Yeah.
And so new meanings need to be found. You know, who are we? Our identity changes, but it can still be a congregation. It can still be a family. It can still be a global family. Right now, the global family is in deep trouble.
Yeah. That's so helpful and beautiful. And we'll put all the notes in our show notes or references to your book so that folks will be able to find it, because I think these are such helpful tools and images, and so grateful for that. So Dr. Boss, we are asking all of our guests this season one final question. And so we're going to move to that. And so as you consider the realities in the world that we have named, and you consider your work and what you have offered to the world, what do you want to be remembered for?
Oh my, I suppose all I've done really is named a kind of loss that was very common, that had never had a name before. Mm. And I'm proud to know that it's now being used internationally through the International Committee of the Red Cross and people with the UN and so on. But it's also used locally and in families and couples. And so just adding a name to the lexicon of what helps people is enough for me. Yeah. Yes. And I'm very happy to do it. I don't know how it happened, but I'm grateful.
Yeah. A grad student from an immigrant family trying to help other families. And here you are, you have helped quite literally millions. And what a gift you are and it has been to be with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. And keep up the good work.
Oh.
it's needed.
Igniting Imagination is a production of the Learning and Innovation team at Wesleyan Impact Partners with excellent editing support from Truthwork Media. Follow us on social media at Wesleyan Impact Partners, visit our website at ignitingimagination.org, and share episodes with friends and colleagues. Our hope is that these conversations can spark imagination in your context. I'm Blair Thompson. On behalf of all of us at Wesleyan Impact Partners, thanks for listening.